Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? We all know what's happening. I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. That was my Citizens app. Oh, I guess the world is ending. Is it? Did you guys get that on yours? It just came up. World is ending. Nowhere to go. Nowhere to hide. I guess that's it. I knew I would be notified on my Citizens app. So the King Chaos Pig provoked and gave orders for an insurrection, a coup, to a hodgepodge bunch of radicalized hate nerds and gamers, gun dorks, bullshit zealots, cosplayers of the fascist ilk. Oh, yes, and Christians. This is where it was going. This was the parade he always wanted. It's ongoing as I'm doing this because, you know, I do this the day before. Who the fuck knows what happened overnight? I'm recording this late afternoon on Wednesday. I'm not a news operation. I can't wait till tomorrow. But it's pretty clear what's happened. And it's pretty clear, you know, that we have a fairly large contingent of anti-American fascistic people in this country who are politically naive and utterly misinformed and excited to believe whatever bullshit honors their self-victimized state. But I mean, what am I going to sit here? I don't have any explanations. I knew this motherfucker wouldn't leave. I knew he wouldn't leave easily. And I knew that he would break the fucking country and the world before he left. I'm not saying that's good to know that. I've just been talking about it for months. But I got no explanation. All the explanations are out there. This was going to happen. This is a hodgepodge, but not without momentum, fascistic movement within our country with a lot of followers and with a leader, our soon-to-be former president. And they're willing to take instructions to overthrow the capital of the United States by the president, who will soon be no longer president, but still the leader of an American fascist movement. That's what's happening. There's no other way to look at it. But the radicalization of the army of unfuckable hate nerds, the gamers, the disenfranchised young men mostly, has been ongoing. Militia groups have been around for a long time. Christian evangelical fascists have been around for a long time. The sort of amalgamation of many of them under the banner of QAnon, which is an ever-evolving spigot of bullshit connecting the dots of history into something that excites and angers and drives the disenfranchised, the racists, the angry. So now what happens? I don't fucking know. I guess we'll see tomorrow. It's like, you know, today would have been a nice day to be like, congratulations. Congratulations. Congratulations to Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff for being elected senators of Georgia. An African-American pastor and a Jew are now the senators representing the state of Georgia. Now that's a nice arc, a nice repairing dating back to the civil rights movement that sort of really kind of legitimizes and lands that journey in a way of these two people and these two backgrounds. And it's also an amazing step in the correct direction politically and on a human level. This would be the day for that. Congratulations. But no. How can we get people who want to believe in fantasy that drives them to violence, to racism, to anti-Semitism, to misogyny, to perhaps murder, to try to overtake the government, to take the Capitol and stop the Congress from doing its democratic work, the work of the people? How can we get the information correct once the brains are broken, when there's no barometer of truth, and when just the desire, the frenzy to believe becomes more important than what is being believed? It's been around since the beginning of people. Why is it raining? Why is my house on fire? Why did my wife die? Why did my husband die? Why is there so much pain and trouble in the world? God, explain it. Make it better, God. Who did this? What bigger force than me? People want to believe in things bigger than themselves and things that are fantastical in order to feel connected to something or to explain something. So once that valve or that portal or that gear in the brain is busted wide open and filled with fucking fascistic crap, what do you do? You storm the Capitol. Well, what do those of us who know the truth do? Be scared and hope there's more of us? I did not mention today on the show, I talked to Stephen Lee Bruner. Not ring a bell? How about Thundercat? That's what he goes by. He's a bass player, singer, songwriter. He's worked a lot with Kendrick Lamar, specifically on To Pimp a Butterfly, and he has 4 solo records out. Great, amazing, transcendent musician. The most recent record is called It Is What It Is, and that is nominated for a Grammy, and I talked to him today. Man, I wish people had something. The plague thing, too, is bearing down, certainly on us here in L.A. and on us everywhere. My mother got shot 1 of the vaccine. I guess she waited a couple hours and had an appointment. She's in the age group there in Florida, so she's on her way to at least a little bit of relief from the fear. Her sister already had the COVID, as did my uncle. But my mother and her boyfriend have not, and they were both inoculated with the first shot, which is good. It's making me squirrely that I know it's out there. I don't know when I can get it, and I know that it's everywhere where I live. It's everywhere here. The relief is so fleeting, man. It's just the relief is so fleeting. I appreciated President-elect Biden's comments. He did say it was seditious, probably. Which it is. He did call it an insurrection, which it is. I'll add anti-American. You can add fascistic, too. But he said, this isn't who we are. But you know what? I got to tell you, this is who some of us are. That is what it is. Some of us are fascists who seek single-party rule and are brain-fucked enough to other everyone but people they see as within their belief system. And that violence can get awful, historically speaking. And we want to believe that it's a minority, and it is. But symbolically, what the pig president did yesterday was signal quite clearly that he will remain their leader. We'll see where that goes. What happens now in the next 2 weeks? That guy should be thrown in fucking jail. After all this sort of projecting that they do, calling Antifa fascists, calling liberal Democrats communists, calling everybody the names evil, he calls us, calls Democrats evil, They are the things that they are projecting. That's the most basic deflection of like a five-year-old. No, I'm not. You are. No, I'm not. You are. No, I'm not. You are. Why are you turning blue? Because my hands are around your throat? I'm not killing you. You are. Whew, man. He should actually be in jail. He should be forced out of office. Ted Cruz should resign. Senator Hawley should resign. They provoked this. They all fucking stood there and helped this along, enabled it, let it happen. Look, there's good and bad people everywhere, right? Know who they are. I hope when you hear this, things have leveled off a little bit. I can't really go on about it. I'm just a comedian, folks. But just know, there might be fascists in your family, and they're proud of it. And they let everybody know that yesterday. So Thundercat is somebody I always wanted to talk to. I first saw him with Kamasi Washington at the Staples Center, I think, or the club at the Staples, Nokia. Club Nokia, I think, is where I saw them. Kamasi had a broken leg. But I was amazed by him, and I've listened to his solo records. I don't know everything he's done, but I enjoyed the album Drunk. I listened to some of his earlier albums, and then this new one is great. It's called It Is What It Is. It's nominated for the Best Progressive R&B Album Grammy, and you can get it wherever you get your music. This is me talking to
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
How you feeling?
Hi.
Hey.
I'm all right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it a rough day already?
You know, somehow between the internet and them showing Teen Titans in the morning, it's Teen Titans. I can't do it with this cartoon. It's the worst cartoon.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, you have choices around cartoons. You don't have to watch them.
True. So many subscriptions. So many.
What is Teen Titans? Is that an old one?
I mean, it's an old DC comic, but it's also like a, I guess they Cartoon Network kind of like. They that's their main cartoon.
They rebooted it?
Yeah, they rebooted it, and it's just been booted. That's what it feels like. It's just
no good.
It's been boot oriented for sure. I feel like I'm getting kicked in the stomach every time I watch it.
Did you grow up with the comics? I mean, was that your thing?
For sure. I'm a Marvel kid through and through. Like I remember the day I started trading Marvel cards in middle school.
Really?
And yeah, I mean, I was a collector of many different things, but Marvel cards was definitely like the beginning for me, you know.
Did you watch the new Wonder Woman?
Yes, I did.
And?
Yeah, it goes right in line with this year. It's a great way to finish the year out.
Disappointed.
You know, the funny thing is I an old head. I went into a comic store one day, and this old head, the guy that worked there, was kind of like, he told me, he's like, hey man, you know, be open to stuff, because it's like, you know, it's got to translate for the kids, it's got to travel the generations, it's got to go past what you know and all that stuff. And he was right. So there's a part of me that's always open to stuff, but as a Marvel kid through it, like literally I have a Marvel tattoo. I have a couple of Marvel tattoos. There's a part of me that was just kind of like, I was watching it with my family, and I felt bad because it was like almost like vomit. I kept booing in between moments, and it was like, I was like, oh, I hope nobody here is going to get pissed. It's like, I couldn't do it, man. I couldn't do it. I watched it, and I was just kind of like, meh.
Did you see the first one?
Yeah. I took my daughter to see the first one.
And you liked that one?
You know what's funny, too? I'll say this. I'll say there's something about it. sucking so much more because of not being able to go to a movie theater.
Sure.
So it's like sharing the experience with my daughter the first time, it was kind of like it was an experience.
Right.
It wasn't just about Wonder Woman, the comic. It was kind of like, you know, I could read between the lines with this movie, and I was like, you know what, it's a good thing. You know, it's like my daughter, she vibed with it a bit, you know, even though my daughter usually listens to like Slipknot and right. It's just like, you know, she had a vibe with it, you know.
I didn't grow up with the comics. I didn't read many comics till I was later in life, and they were just like Swamp Thing, Sandman, Hellblazer. Like, I didn't grow up.
That's the good stuff, though.
Yeah, yeah, great. I don't know why. I was in my 30s, and I was like, this is the best.
Nice.
But I didn't grow up with it or caring about it. Now, when I watch a Marvel movie, if I ever do, I'm always disappointed because I don't know. I'm not expecting anything, and I'm a grown-up. So,
you know, but it's an age-old tale, I think. I think that there's always a hard thing for adaptation. It's like something that I said this to another comic store owner friend of mine. I was like, there's something about the idea of fantasy when you solidify it or make it real that it just like dispels it for you. You know, it's like there's a part where even the pictures...
Right. You don't engage any of your own imagination. You're just reacting to this thing. Whereas for some reason, if you have the ability to contain a story that's written in panels, which not everybody does, that you don't really realize how much room there is in your imagination because these are just still panels. And you, after a certain point, you're not even paying that much attention to them. They're there just to provoke your imagination somehow.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens.
Right. So the relationship is a lot different than having it all done for you and then, you know, having to trust that person to do it for you. I mean, who the fuck is that person? You know?
Like, exactly. Exactly. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, like a couple of the moments I was kind of like seeing the superpowers in real life, you kind of go, hey, I could probably kick his ass.
Yeah, yeah, that guy.
Yeah. Like, yeah, like I could probably beat him up, you know?
Yeah. He's not scary. Yeah. I guess for me, the first one was good in ways that a lot of comic book people didn't like. Like, I liked the ending, you know, like all the big weirdness of the ending, but they thought that was sort of like a sellout or something kind of overcompensating. I said, well, what are we working towards if it's not going to be something great like that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, there's so much to pull from with these stories. It's like, it could afford to go anywhere, man. And you know, one thing I will say too, is that one thing that's dope is that it highlights a home guy, the guy that also plays the Mandalorian.
He was great.
Yeah.
He was the best thing about that movie.
Yeah, he played a real creep.
The great thing about his creep, though, was like, it was an insecure creep, and you could see his insecurities from the get-go. So you kind of had this weird empathy, you know, which makes him a more interesting evil guy, because you're like, oh, he's just a insecure loser. He's like Trump.
Yeah.
He's just like...
The comb-over and everything, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't have much empathy for Trump, but I mean, if you could, it would look like the Wonder Woman villain.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm a huge Kristen Wiig fan, and it's always good to see her. You know what I mean?
Like,
I
didn't understand that whole part. I guess you have to know the comic books for it. Like, why turn her into an animal when there's no real precedent for that? Like,
there you
out go. Of nowhere, she's just an animal. And as a guy who doesn't know the comics, I was like, well, that's a weird choice.
Yeah, Cheetah. I knew who that character was, but I was also just like, it was one of those moments where I was like, you know, it's kind of like, it felt like a really bad cut and paste. It's like,
yeah, some of that stuff looked really bad.
Kristen Wiig's amazing, and here's Cheetah. And it was just like, all right, well.
You know what else I just watched? I watched that Frank Zappa documentary.
Oh, nice.
Did you watch it?
No, I've been meaning to. I've been completely just sitting here staring at the sky and then like watching Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah.
I'm a total anime nerd, man. I'm just like,
yeah,
you know, through and through. So it's like, it's the gist of this has been me sitting here tripping out watching hella anime. But like,
if fantasy works for you and it gives you relief, that's great. Like, I don't have that. I just have, you know, dread and...
existential dread.
Yeah. And you wrote a song about that. Which album was that on? Was that on the new one? Existential Dread?
That was the new one.
That was good. Yeah, I could relate to that. I could relate to a lot of the songs. But I was watching, like, I talked to Bootsy a couple weeks ago, and then I watched a Zappa doc.
Mm.
So, you know, talking about Parliament and then watching, you know, what Zappa's trying to do and then listening to some of the stuff you've done. And the first time... I saw you with Kamasi, when Kamasi had his broken leg and he was sitting in a throne down at down at
Staples. Yeah.
It was was that at the Staples? It was a I can't remember where we saw it, but you guys had been somewhere, and he had to sit in that giant chair because he couldn't walk.
It wasn't the Mayan.
I don't think so. I feel like it was like you had just returned. It was in the small room at the Staples Center in the smaller lounge. Maybe it was, I mean, and that was when I first saw you, and I was like, how many strings are on that bass? So, but I guess the point being is that, you know, my understanding of where music goes and what music can do, it seems something that you're highly aware of, and there seems to be no real boundary to it.
Yeah, no, it's very open. I blame it on how I was raised, and you know, I always feel like the somewhere between the lines is where we exist with the stuff. So we got to always consistently blur those lines, you know.
Yeah. Well, how does your upbringing relate?
Well, quite literally. I mean, basically me and Kamasi and my brother, and we kind of. Amongst other people, we were kind of born together, so to speak. Me and Kamasi's dad used to play together in high school or in college. And
your
stuff
dad?
Like that. Yeah, our parents. And even...
what was his instrument?
Kamasi, my dad's instrument was the drums.
Kamasi's dad's a horn player, right?
Kamasi's dad is a horn player, yeah. And then also another one like that is George Ann Muldrow. Like, our parents grew up playing together. And they had us, and it was kind of like, you know, you got that could go one of a couple of ways. You know, you got the kids that resents what because it's always being shoved down their
right.
throat.
But it
actually translated otherwise. It turned into like, you know, it kind of passed down to us. So there's a part of it where we started taking it really serious at a really young age. Like at a very young age, we got a chance
with the
likes of Reggie Andrews and the Thelonious Monk Institute and all these different, you know, things as we were kids were very it kind of cultivated our ability. And then on top of that, we were also doing stuff like playing in nightclubs. And you know, like I was the kid where, you know, I couldn't stand in front of or behind the club, and then but I would come in to play, and then they would kick me out and throw me down the street.
Right.
You know, like we were those kids. Yeah, yeah. And but anytime it was a chance, anytime we got a chance to play, and it was like we got a chance to grow, we would take it.
But you would go see your folks. You would see your father's play a lot.
Oh yeah,
right? I mean, you could go to the rehearsal space or wherever.
Yeah.
So like at that time, like because like I've came. You know, I always kind of knew about jazz. I listen to jazz a lot more now. I've broadened my collection a little bit.
Yeah.
And you know, I can't wrap my brain around theory or anything like that. You know, I play guitar, but I don't read music or necessarily understand things about it, but I can listen to stuff. You know, I have pretty adventurous ears. Like, stuff doesn't bother me no matter how weird it gets.
Yeah.
So, like, when you're younger, I mean, what kind of jazz were you being brought up with, really?
Oh, everything from big band to jazz fusion. To straight ahead, it was kind of all embedded. We like growing up with Reggie Andrews was kind of like, you know, everything from we would listen to jazz in the morning, and he would always quiz us on, you know, it was kind of things where we would have to be able to tell who was playing by how they
really?
Sounded. Yeah. So we would sit and listen to the radio, and it would be little incentive things like that he would reward us for. He'd be like, man, who is this? And he'd be like, man, that sound like Ornette Coleman, or that sound like Wayne Shorter. You know, you hear certain types of note selection and stuff like that, or certain
and
tone.
And you can do it?
Yeah.
You can tell these guys, most of them?
Yeah, it was kind of how, you know, from that to, like, the types of standards we would learn. Like, Kamasi's dad, we would practice at Kamasi's dad's house a lot, and Cameron Graves is another one. We would practice at their parents' house, and, you know, Kamasi's dad would give Kamasi, like, a task or give us a task to write a tune or learn a tune a day.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to sit back here and play, it's cool to be playing, but like challenge yourself with learning something new, and it skews and offsets the comfortability of how, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then from that to like, you know, we would compete in like the John Coltrane Jazz Awards and stuff like that. We would do all kinds of stuff, and we would just be
That's
involved.
That's a hell of an exercise.
Yeah. It was like, it was a constant learning. Even when you're like sleeping, it was learning. It was, me and Kamasi, when I remember the day Amoeba, I remember the day Amoeba set up and became a reality, and me and Kamasi used to live there. Like, Kamasi would go to UCLA, or, and, you know, him and Cameron would be in school, and then after they get out of school or when they would be on break, they come back to their, you know, they stayed in a spot at one point, and we would just go get in the car, buy a burrito, and go to Amoeba and spend like 5 hours there and come out with this sea of music. And like, it's just, we'd be sitting in the car eating burritos, listening to like some new Tchaikovsky or some you know, like, what is this? Okay, you know, just examining stuff like that and trying to listen with bigger ears, you know?
So it was all music and Marvel for you.
Oh yeah, man, that's in anime, music, Marvel, and anime, and that was, when I say that's to this day, it's kind of like that's what everybody is always up against with me. Where it's just like, in my most profound moment, I will still make a Dragon Ball reference. it's embedded in me, man.
I think that's maybe that's some of the stuff that I don't quite understand on some of the records, was are references to things that I don't know about.
Yeah, no, it's
Dragon
it's,
Ball.
Dragon Ball is life. That's what it is. You know, Dragon Ball is.
What
life.
Is it?
It's one of the best cartoons ever created in the history of cartooning. It's like, you got Mickey Mouse, you know, you got Gundam, you know, you got Marvel, you got. I mean, I'm not going to fully be a hater. I'm going to say for some, it's DC.
Gundam, is that the. Is that the Western with the Sensei?
No. You got Gundam is a Japanese cartoon. That's it's just Giant Robo. It's kind of like in the earlier years of Giant Robo. There's a lot of different Giant Robo, but you know, you got all these different things. You got Hello Kitty from Japan. You got all this stuff, but Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, and now Dragon Ball Super, skipping Dragon Ball GT. It's like. It's kind of like this, it's the story of this, it's basically following this alien kid as he's growing and watching him learn how to be human. It's kind of, it's got a lot of parallels to like stuff that we recognize, like a Superman or like a, you know, or just a, you know, the X-Men and stuff like that. It's like, he's an alien.
What's the matter with GT?
GT, I don't know, man. GT just felt really it felt like neither here nor there. There was some good stuff in it, you know, certain moments, but it felt like the trope of, as compared to the feeling or the quality of Dragon Ball Z. So you would see, you know, like certain obstacles Goku and the guys had to overcome in Z were like really like you could feel it. You know, Goku would die and like they had to wish him back, and then they only had this one. They can only wish certain people back, so just executive decisions would have to be made about who they'd bring back, and Goku comes back 10 times powerful. He's been traveling astral, and it's like he's been doing all kinds of stuff. So the story of Goku from a boy starts at Dragon Ball, and then Dragon Ball Z is him as a man, and then Dragon Ball GT is just him after listening to Flock of Seagulls or something. I don't know. And then Dragon Ball Super is him as a god, you know, and it's got a bit
of
a.
But you explain it to me, and it's like, you know, even if I'm interested, it feels like it would take a lifetime for me to catch up.
Dragon Ball Z. I mean, there's Cliff's Notes versions of it, and the truth is the manga is what it started as, and. If you were into reading like that, I mean, if you wanted to check out Dragon Ball, it's always available. It's like it's like Batman. It's like it's a common. There's a good you could pick up at different points, and it would still be like, oh, I get it. Okay, Dragon Ball Z.
That's good. Okay, well, how did this? When you look about, when you think, do you have a whole room in your house full of vinyl and one full of comic books? I mean,
it's all in the same space. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Like it's all not separated. It's all vinyls. Comics, video games, toys, it's just here.
Right.
Looks like Nakano Broadway in here.
Well, when you think about it, do you feel that, you know, somehow or another, whatever your love for comic and fantasy planted in you influenced the music or your ability to see music differently?
Yeah, man. The cartoons, I'm not going to lie, the cartoons inspire the music. It's like like everything, Naruto and cartoons like Naruto and Cowboy Bebop and Dragon Ball Z, they inspire me to push harder, like to know that there is more there. You just have to push harder. Like it's always, anytime I've ever watched Naruto, like it made me feel like I can be a better person. Like anytime I would watch it, I immediately would start doing push-ups or like, you know, or
oh,
like,
really?
You know, I spent most of this year, and like, as we're talking about this year, and I mean, there was a giant weight loss that happened for me. And
yeah, you look lean. I remember when I saw you with Kamasi, you were heavier.
kind of bulbous. Yeah.
Bulbous with your big bass, five strings.
Yeah, it's like, it's one of those things where a lot of stuff.
Was it six strings or five?
Six strings. A lot of things, but every now and again, you can definitely catch me playing a five too. It's like, it's one of those things where a lot of things had changed rapidly on the death of one of my best friends, and also the loss of like a person I was really in love with. It became really difficult. So I went through a weird moment of being depressed for real. And
this was like this year. So you had some.
This started a couple years back. And
so your friend died, and someone you were in love with died.
No, they didn't die. They just left me.
Oh, okay. Both of them, or the one passed away and one left you.
Yeah, and it was kind of consecutive, and it was like, it started
grief
back
is
then.
The worst,
and,
man.
And I
grief
like, is the yeah, worst. And when Mac passed, personally, it changed my life.
Oh, Mac, that's right.
Yeah,
Mac Miller, yeah.
Yeah, and I think from that time period till now, a lot of changes drastically happened that would result in me physically changing. So I became vegan and I stopped drinking because it's basically like I feel like I had seen too much, you know?
Well, I mean, I noticed that with, going through all the records, from Apocalypse forward, that when you talk from the first person, it's interesting. There's a style of songwriting that, like, I noticed a little more in jazz. Like, I was listening to Horace Silver's later albums where he incorporated, vocals and stuff.
But, yeah.
He had brought in people. And, there is a type of earnest sort of presentation in some of that more experimental jazz singing where, no one's looking for hooks, but it's more philosophical and more straightforward, And it's not... it's not based on rhyme or anything other than ideas, right? So there's some of the stuff that I was listening to, and I was like, there were points in the work where I was thinking that, is he writing from the first person, or is he creating a character here? Because if he's writing from the first person, this guy's heading for a wall.
And so is life, right? Here you go.
All right.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, no,
it's... Because it seems like you're drinking too much, and you got a heavy heart, and you're too sensitive, and you get in trouble in Japan. That's what I got out of it.
That is quite literal, sir. That is me in real life. Yes.
Well, that's good that you pulled it together, man. But it's all in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're pretty honest in your work, once I get past the sort of, the music, which is great, but just listening to you. So it was because you worked with Mac Miller a bit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was one of my best friends. Yeah.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
It's hard, man. Did you see the struggle with drugs with him?
Yeah. I was there for the most part of that. Yeah.
And that was a wake up call for you in the midst of the grief, where you realized that even if you weren't doing the same drugs, that perhaps you were increasing your odds of mortality.
Yeah. I really hate that it took that when I look back in hindsight, but.
Uh huh.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like, I just, something had to give.
Right.
Right.
And you don't want it to be your mind or your life.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So,
it seems like.
You either get the lesson or you get out of here.
For sure. One way or the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, well, I'm glad that you chose the art and the faith and the decision to change the life. Find some hope.
Yeah. Watch a lot of Star Wars.
But what about the work? I mean, is the album It Is What It Is, the processing of that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, I think it was like, somewhere between real life. It's like, again, like we were saying, sometimes stuff with me can be a bit literal. And, yeah, that was me processing it. That was the change happening. And
yeah.
It just was kind of, it's again, it's like, looking back on it, it was really, it was a bit traumatizing. It was a bit, emotionally traumatizing, at least.
It's terrible, man. And it's like I, you know, I went through something this year, just terrible. And there's nothing, you know, when you lose somebody, and your heart breaks, you know, both, you know, like however you lose people, it's heartbreaking. And you get to a point, you know, I'm older than you, where you're like, you know, I don't know how much of this shit I can take. You know, how yeah. much are we built? Are we built to handle this? I don't know if I could do another one of these, yeah. you know, and when it's death, then, you know, 'cause that's a surprising one. Then you're like, well, shit, they, you know, there's no avoiding this. And we're all going to deal with this grief if we live long enough one way or the other. Yeah. But if it's people leaving or you leaving, then it's like, man, I don't have to do this again. Like it's as my buddy Brendan said, you know, you sort of earn your stripes as a human when you process this shit without, you know, destroying yourself.
There you go. Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with that, you know. You know, and it's, you know, it's never easy, but you don't realize that, you know, like you don't realize it's always like you have to, it's going to, you know, the consistent having to overcome and trying to like,
oh yeah,
be able to still walk straight after somebody hits you in the side of the head with a glass bottle. You know, it's like, it's a lot. It's a lot, man. And
did the work help? When you were doing the music, did it help?
I mean, I remember it's always, music has always been a bit therapeutic and a bit like it becomes that. But I think in this moment, it was like overwhelmingly painful. So if I didn't have Flying Lotus there with me, and he's always been there with me, like I always talk about him, but it's the truth. If Flying Lotus wasn't there with me to help me see me through some of these moments, it just would be me tail spinning. You know, and
yeah, he's a good friend, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It's genuinely like beyond the music. Even though I always say when I refer to him, I always say people can hear our relationship in the music, but
yeah,
beyond the music, it's one of these things where it's like, I don't know. He's just always, I feel like he's always cared for me. You know,
yeah,
and
it's
like,
important when you're in the grief.
Yeah, in those moments, he's kind of. You know, he would help me be able to stay standing straight when stuff would right. wallop me on the side of the head like that, you know?
Right. Yeah. To hold you up in a way, you know, to get you like, cause like when my girlfriend passed away in May, you know, I got a friend who, you know, he just started calling me and we talk every fucking night, man, you know, for, you know, even now.
Yeah,
like, you know, right from the get-go, and it was just sort of like, it's grounding, because if you're just left to sit in it and you don't got no love coming your way in the form of just a guy going like, what's going on, what'd you do, what'd you eat, you know, what have you been thinking about, did you read a thing, you know, whatever, just to be like, ugh, get me, you know, out of it, you know,
yeah.
for a minute, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man.
And then Flying Lotus, so like, that guy's a genius, you're a genius, so like, you know, you're swirling around in the possibilities. You know, I imagine that outside the friendship, you're like, well, let's get into this thing. What's that thing you were working on?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Lotus can keep me focused, man. He really can.
What's that guy's background? Because I talked to Anderson .Paak about him, and then I went on a little spin with some of his work. And I knew, like, before I knew you guys were buddies or worked together, like a couple days ago when I knew I was going to talk to you, I'm like, he's got to be with Flying Lotus because... The groove is sort of similar where you guys are going.
Yeah.
So that you kind of inform each other, huh?
Yeah, yeah. That's how there's a moment where you see stuff in weird shades and gradients. I still remember vividly meeting him at South by Southwest. I remember what
really?
He was wearing. I remember his sentiment. I remember the necklace. I remember the shoes. I remember how hot it was. And it was like, it was one of the greatest moments, you know, not knowing, like, unbeknownst to both of us. It was kind of like, it was kind of those things like, man, we should hang out. And it was like, we should definitely hang out. And
yeah.
And
yeah.
it just, it, you know, like life changes and the different growth. And
did you know his work before you met him?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We both knew of each other's work I feel like I was a little bit more spotty back in the day. I didn't have albums. It wasn't something that was like solidified like that until I signed a Brain Feeder Records. But
uh-huh.
Me and he knew of my work by way of like the different things like Saw Rock Creative Partners and Erykah Badu and different different people that I would work with. And he was, you know, it's like we both knew that there was something that, you know, it was like, yeah, man. And I was a very big fan of his work, of course, you know. You know, this man is the sound of Los Angeles, you know.
And, yeah, it's like it's interesting when I enter the world that you guys live in musically, because it's not really my world. And when I go in there, I realize a couple of things, like, well, this is amazing and deep and broad. And I, you know, I where the fuck am I living? You know, like hey, this is happening all right, the time. Okay. And I, every once in a while I walk into it, I'm like, holy shit, there's a whole other planet here, you know? And I,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Cause all you guys kind of, you know, like the world of him, Flying Lotus, and you and Kamasi and Kendrick, and like there's a whole like amalgamation of different styles of music sort of constantly coming together among the crew that you guys are seem to be with.
Yeah, no, at any given moment, you know, we'll get together and something comes of it. You know, it's just, I think that's just kind of a somewhere between, like, you know, that's like the, I don't want to say byproduct of the environment, but as compared to just, right. it's somewhere between the actual relations and relationships that you have with each other. Yeah. And there's no way it's not going to translate musically.
Right.
You know, it's because music is the way we communicate. It's like, there's right. a part of it where it's embedded in there. You know, it's like, you know, you're looking for a chance to, oh, let me accentuate, you know, you're like, you're kind of like, okay, let me see if I can challenge this a bit, or like, oh, let me, you know, it's like we're constantly tinkering with each other's stuff, you know? And
well, it's interesting to me, like you guys, like you and Kamasi, like, come on, like when I first heard Epic, you know, I talked to him years ago, you know, he talked to me, and I, like, you know, I heard Epic and I'm like, holy shit, man, the production on this is insane. And then I realized, you know, when you guys play, when I saw you play live, that like you're playing live. Like, you know, all that stuff is not, you're not doing tracks, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm like, holy shit, you know, he's got the choral group there. He's got the strings over here. He's got his dad and he's got you and another guy on bass. There's two keyboards. Like, I'm like, what the fuck is happening? Two drummers, you know, like, anyway, but.
You got to imagine that
happening.
Being, wait, you want to hear something funny? You got to imagine that in a small nightclub off of Crenshaw Boulevard, like the whole entire, without the orchestra and the strings, but the whole yeah. band hanging out and trying to play at like Fifth Street Dick's in Leimert Park or Doughboys yeah. Dozens. We'd be hanging out the side of the club. Half the band would be outside the club.
Oh my God.
That would just be some of the funniest moments. You know, you got Cameron and Brandon playing and me and Miles and, you know, Isaac and Terrence Kamasi, everybody. We would just be playing. And then half, there wouldn't, it was like, man, there doesn't really need to be an audience because we're the audience.
Yeah, so the many of you.
Yeah, half the club would be the band. A little small coffee house, like 15 band members. Yeah. Like, who's getting paid from this?
Like, yeah, nobody.
Yeah, it's, they pay us in coffee and sandwiches.
But that's what, that was the kind of the primal soup of the thing, right?
I mean, that's where that was us. That's who we were, you know?
But like, my point was, like, when I listened to Epic, I was like, this is groundbreaking. And it is, but then I listened to Mingus, and I'm like, oh, well, there, that choral thing's sort of a precedent, you know, that, I mean, that's been around.
Yeah.
Right? So I started to put that stuff together, and then when I listen to you, like, there's definitely, like, you know, there's a Kamasi jazz, and then there's, you know, what you're doing is a little different in your own way, right? Your approach is more fusion-oriented, where Kamasi's, like, pretty much, he's traditional hard bop, bebop, like, he's coming from a different place in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all embedded in there. You know,
yeah,
our first album together we recorded as the Young Jazz Giants when we were kids. It was just, you know, it was kind of like we would try to, you know, incorporate everything that everybody was into, you know. And it's like there's a
right.
I'm playing upright on the album. I'm like there's a song called Steven's Song where it's kind of like, you know, it was me on electric bass, you know. And then there's like this giant drum solo at the end, and then Cameron, and then, you know, it's Cameron's insanely gifted piano playing. One person I feel like I don't talk about enough is Cameron Graves, to be honest with you. Cameron, and it's just growing up with a Cameron Graves also was a, it was a really big deal. Between Cameron and Kamasi, they were always teaching me, you know, they were always showing me how to play through what they would be processing. And like, oh, this is the, these scales go with this. This is what fits here. Like, they would be from that to like, ah, oh, nah, man, you know, like the repetition, the part where I learned the repetition was growing up with Cameron Graves. I would watch a guy sit and practice piano for 9 hours a day growing up. Wow. Literally, we could be having a conversation. It wouldn't matter. He had the metronome on. He'd be chewing his tongue and going through the scales while you're trying to sit here and play Resident Evil. And, you know, and then he'd get up and play some Resident Evil, you know, and then go right back to playing. You know, it's just, it was, that's, that was my upbringing, you know, and I was very fortunate to have Cameron and Kamasi and my older brother as teachers. You know what I mean?
And what, like early on, you know, outside of those guys, you know, and living in the sort of world of jazz all the time. I mean, what, who were the people, the artists that really kind of connected with you early on where you were like that, you know, like, I want to play bass. I want to play bass like that. Or, you know, I get it now.
It was definitely, definitely Jocko and Stanley.
No, Stanley Clark, right.
Jocko and Stanley, like, in it, again, of course, the introduction is to Jocko around the age of, I'm around 10 or so. And the same thing with Stanley.
Yeah.
I was of a certain age. And then, you know, it's one of those things where I had many different moments. I remember everybody would always talk to me about different, you know, different cats growing up, you know, again, Ray Brown and, you know, Mingus, of course, and stuff like that. And
right.
Then I would, you know, Ron Carter, of course, and Miroslav Vitus. Like, but it's funny because I think that the place that it lies specifically for me was in the jazz fusion era, because there was everything in being embodied in those moments, from upright to electric. And yeah. I felt like in that moment, as a transitional part of the music, I think there was somewhere where I knew that there was a place for me that existed. You know what I mean? It's like there's a part of it where it's like, oh, as a bassist, being able to do all of that. You know, like some, like this is okay. This, you can do, it was like almost like being introduced to what, this is what you can do with your instrument.
Right, right.
You know?
Right. Well, yeah, I get it. Yeah, because like, you know, because of the way you grew up, you realized on some level that there were limitations to traditional jazz. Right. So I imagine, you know, getting hip to Stanley Clark or Jocko, you started to like the departure from upright to like almost any possibility at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And then two other important ones are Anthony Jackson and Paul Jackson. Anthony Jackson, like, changed my sense of melody and harmony tremendously, you know. It's kind of like one of those things where all, I mean, there's only a few bass players that I would always say I wanted to be like growing up. It was definitely Stanley and Jocko, and it was Anthony Jackson. Anthony Jackson and Paul Jackson. And Anthony Jackson played electric, you know. I mean, I'd have my favorites, Eddie Gomez and Charlie Hayden and stuff like that. I was very aware of different, you know, cats growing up. But Anthony Jackson's relation to melody and how often he would be able to, how effortlessly he would change the course of music from the simplest place. It just always was like, I want to be able to do that. I was like, I want to be able to do that. I want to. It was like you could hear him talking under the music. It was crazy.
Well, that's what, I guess that's what, that's the opportunity that bass gives you, is that you can just sort of like almost quietly change everything.
Yeah.
Like,
you know. Yeah, it's.
You know, it's like, where are we now? And I don't know. The bass player just did something, and we're in a different place entirely.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, I always feel like, and we, you know, we always say, you know, oh, lead singers and guitarists, you know, oh, sure. You're like, we know deep down bass players around the world.
They do. The rhythm section runs the world, really, right?
Yes.
And I don't understand that relationship with the, like, you know, I learned about it later in life just, like, listening to rock music that, you know, that if the rhythm section isn't tight, the whole project's a mess.
Yeah, you wouldn't drive a Lamborghini with a donut. I mean,
yeah,
you don't have your wheels aligned properly.
Yeah, but where do you put like people like you know? I have to assume, only because I just talked to him a couple of weeks ago, that Bootsy is important.
Oh Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah, man. And yeah. To be honest with you, like, the man, oh man. And it's like, again, Bootsy and Bernie Worrell, to me, yeah, that was also who I wanted to be like.
Well, I hear it, like, all through your records, like, there's, like, you know, because, you know, you get a groove and you're not concerned with hooks, you know, you're kind of concerned about, you know, movement, but everyone, like, there's that Bernie Worrell style synthesizer that just pop in occasionally, like, whee!
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay, there's a reminder.
It's, yes,
like, of something, yeah, you know, an intergalactic reminder.
Yeah, yeah, man, yeah. Oh, man, Bootsy and Bernie, man, it's just, it's... And it's like somewhere between being able to vacillate between roles as the instrument is always like leaned on, or it always has like this heavy anchor,
right,
trying to find the ways that it like can also become texture, can also become progression. It could also become, you know, percussive, you know, like finding those places.
Yeah, because like I noticed that, like, you know, if you lay a couple of bass tracks down, because I noticed that yesterday, it might be on the new record, where, you know, you're kind of, you know, doing something very upfront with the bass as a, you know, a single voice almost, where, you know, this is the bass singing here up front. But then all of a sudden, like, a different bass will, you know, drop that bottom beat, you know, as a percussion.
Yeah.
But you're still on top of it with the other one, or however you're working that. And then you really kind of illustrate what you're talking about, the two differences to, you know, the approach and the possibilities of bass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like Bootsy, like what struck me about him, talking to him, is like out of nowhere on this last record, this new one that he did, The One, you know, he's playing with George Benson. And I'm like, George Benson? Really?
Yeah.
And then like, you, but then you... You know, you got Kenny Loggins, you got Michael McDonald, but you've got this respect, you know, coming through fusion in the 70s for these cats that, like, in my youth, I might have found a little boring, right? So, like, George Benson, you know, George Benson's all right. You know, I know him from the hits when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bootsy's like, I always wanted to play with George Benson. And I'm like, really?
But oh, George, you guys, can rip, man.
I know, he's great.
Yeah.
I judged because of my association. You know, it's hard for me to sort of adapt to fusion, dude. I don't know why. Like, out of all the jazz styles, it's hard for me. And
yeah.
I think one of the reasons is because there is a kind of softness to it. And I, you know, I require anxiety. And you know what I mean? I need the jazz to have a Ritalin effect on my own trip. Like,
I hear you.
You do? Okay.
Yes.
But listening to you, or listening to Lotus, that, like, you know, if you want to go on the ocean and, you know, just, you know, take that journey, you know, it's here for you. You know, if you want to be in a fucking storm, then, you know, go live there. But
right.
You have this, right?
Right. Right. I hear you.
Does that make
sense? That makes total sense, man. I'm like, I don't know. And I go like this. Well, here you go. That's where enter George Duke and Frank Zappa.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, man. Right. Because like that stuff, like you listen to the production on that shit and there's no way it's not going to be hard on you. It's not going to be harsh no matter what Frank's doing. The way that they put that stuff together, you know, stuff that is pretty aggressively dissonant and challenging,
yeah,
but still there's such a ring to it, you're like, I'm okay with this, it's not making me aggravated.
You know? yeah
But what was it like, you know, I guess Jaco and Stanley would do it, because that seems to be, you know, where you prefer to live, is in that kind of, you know, starting with that fusion foundation.
Yeah, man, it's, I don't know, because it's like, I think it's important,
yeah,
man. On to a major degree, like the ability and prowess of the instruments, you know, like your physical ability, it's like, it's important. It's just as important, you know? And I feel like there's a lot of, I mean, and like I said, I always am a firm believer in the idea of somewhere in between, you know, like finding where it's almost like, it's no different than a marriage or love for something, you know, it's like the hard work,
right,
as compared to the feelings and stuff like that, and trying to understand how to balance those things, it's literally always somewhere in between. I think the same, and when it comes to the music, I think like, okay, be able to have that, but then also be able to pull back, but then also be able to, you know, like intensify and
right,
have something to say. You know, it's imperative. And
also structurally, like because of the way you've set up how you conceive of albums and music, like you've really set up a situation where you can do whatever you want. You know, for like, you know, you have 30-second, 40-second, 2-minute pieces, but you can move through any sound you want.
I mean, well, you know, one of my favorite things is I always say, you know, like DRI can do a 20-second song and nobody will bat an eyelash to it. You know?
Right.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's like, that's all in there. I'm like, you know what? Sometimes that's all you have to say. You know, it's like,
right,
sometimes that one moment is it, and it's not
right
meant to be anything.
Why not let it be its own thing?
I think those moments are just as important, you know?
Yeah, and you've probably gone over this before, but like, talk to me about, because it seems like you and Kamasi and whatever you guys, you know, how that all came together with Kendrick on To Pimp a Butterfly, that there was something fundamental about, like, I now know the evolution out of, you know, jazz into hip hop into rap. Like, I watched a documentary on the Blue Note, on Blue Note Records, and I never put it together quite like that. And now I kind of get that. But it seems to me that when you guys did that album, that you had really sort of discovered the kind of the perfect symbiosis between jazz and rap. Do you feel that something was that, like, because of, I guess, Kendrick's sensitivity to, you know, what you guys were doing, or I don't know if he grew up with you guys, that you created something, I would say, almost totally original with that record because of the jazz element?
Yeah, man, that album, it was the definition of a perfect storm, you know?
Yeah, how'd that happen?
Man, you got, you know, it's the snapshot of everything that was literally happening at the time. If we were going to keep it musically,
yeah,
it's one of those things where everybody's mind and heart was open in that one moment,
right,
to trying to push into something new.
Uh-huh.
And the way he would go about bringing that about, you know, it's like sometimes it's like the part where, yeah, you got to get us all in a room together sometimes, you know, that's definitely a part,
yeah,
of it. You know, everybody, along with their heart and mind being in the same place, it's like physically with the instruments and stuff like that, you know, we were spending a lot of time in different ways and stuff like that. You know, me and Kamasi are always on tour in our own worlds and stuff like that. And
yeah,
at this point, I'm writing music like every day. You get on the computer and, you know, I'm digging around up here and, you know, digging around,
right,
over here. And
yeah,
and it's a bit like, you know, it was kind of like everybody brought their best to that moment. I think, you know, this is,
and did you guys know Kendrick? Did you grow up with him?
Not in the same way that I grew up with the Kamasi. I didn't know Kendrick as a kid, no, but in the process of working, he reminded me, or let me know, the first time that he, you know, he got a chance to interact with me. And it was like, I think I was playing with this group, J Davy, and him and his group, I think Black Hippie, opened for J Davy at one point.
Uh-huh.
And he expressed to me how he remembers seeing me play with him. And I think I had met him. And that was, again, years prior to Pimp a Butterfly coming out, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was hard for me to remember, too, because, again, mentally, I'd be in a different place back then, of course, you know. But,
sure.
You know, it was crazy because it was one of those moments where I think that this was a moment where he just wanted to bring me in to what it was, I guess, a bit. And I'm happy he did, you know. I'm very happy he did.
And it was open, right? So, like, because it seems to me that generally is not, like, you and Kamasi had a shorthand. And, you know, and you were all, it seemed like the creative convergence was not that common in that world, in the sense that using real instruments and whatnot. Is that,
yeah,
true?
No, we again, this is years and years of us having played together, so it's like, it's one of those things where if,
right,
you know, you get us in a room, it's not gonna not happen, you know. It's like, it's that's what we've spent our,
yeah,
life,
yeah,
doing. So it's like, you know, even if we hadn't seen each other in ages, or like I was saying, Kamasi being on tour,
right,
I being on tour, or, you know, Miles doing his thing, or however this translates, it's like, you know, it's, you know, we would learn, we've known each other's music since we were kids. So, you know, you start playing a tune and like, oh yeah, I remember that tune, or like, you know,
And Kendrick was just open to it because he knew what you guys were capable
of? Yeah, or he would take elements of it and like, you know, he'd place it or he'd find places for it.
Yeah, right. So what's your relationship with Japan?
Man, you know, it definitely, again, it started when I was a kid. It definitely started early on, you know.
Through anime?
It was definitely anime, for sure. Definitely anime, for sure. Realizing how much stuff was anime as a kid. I always talk about it where it's kind of like,
yeah,
you know, all of our cartoons from like He-Man to Silverhawks to, you know, the Mighty Orbots to the Transformers to Thundercats. Those were all Japanese animators. You know, She-Ra, Princess of Power, freaking, what's the other one? Jim and the Holograms. We were already being fed that. And then on top of that, my first introduction to Dragon Ball Z was a bracelet that I got at a dentist office. And I remember it because I also, I don't talk about it as much, but I also illustrate. I'm also an illustrator. And it started back then for me. I was kind of like intrigued with the shapes of the figures and stuff like that. And then from there, from that moment, again, it's like it's so embedded in interweaved and stuff. You know, I was there when Pokemon was incepted. You know, it's kind of like the inception of Pokemon cards. Huh?
Well, you were there in Japan?
No. Like, I mean, the introduction of the Pokemon kid. I was one of those kids from that to realizing the Power Rangers was a Japanese franchise. You know, like, all of that was like, it would just be swirling around, and at different points you'd tap in and be like, oh, wow, of course that's Japan. You're like, oh, that's Japan. And then you get older and you're like, of course it's Japan. And then... Right. You know,
they're jazz heads too over there. Too,
oh,
right?
for sure. And yeah, you see the connection.
Yeah.
But do you
go over there? Do you spend time there?
Yeah, yeah. It's my happy place, to be honest with you. I go there. Yeah. I go there and just completely turn into a Japanese schoolgirl, and then
the Tokyo. What album's that on Tokyo?
That's on Drunk, I think.
Oh man, that sounds like a pretty good night.
Yeah. Restless Nights in Tokyo, man. Yeah. Yeah. I've had some wild moments in Tokyo. Oh God. Yeah. Oh my God. But it's like so all of that kind of going in and around, and then like, you know, my first introduction to anime was like when Cognizant introduction to anime, the one job I ever worked was at a comic store called Collector's Paradise. And it was my summer job
Where's that? That's here, right?
Yeah, Collector's Paradise. I'm pretty sure it's all around the States.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I worked there when I was around between the age of 10 and 14 or something like that, you know, when my grades were really good and I didn't have anything to do in the summer. And I wasn't practicing. I wouldn't practice 24 hours a day. So my dad was like, you got to get out and do something. So I would go work at the comic store. Yeah, I would work at the comic store, and they would like let me bag and board comics. And I got to make sure the displays were right and make sure kids weren't stealing stuff. You know, they would have to make sure I wasn't stealing stuff. And then, but like one of the first things I remember when they got a TV in the store. And they would play like, you know, old crazy Korean horror films, and they would play anime.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing Fist of the North Star and Street Fighter first. And I remember Street Fighter was so cool as an anime. I was like, whoa, this looks insane. These characters, this is insane. And I remember maybe somebody in the store was like, oh, you like anime? And I was like, you know, oh, okay, that's what this is. And then here comes the flood of Pokemon, Dragon Ball Z, and all this other stuff. And I'm just like, oh my God, I love anime, you know.
So they saw you, and then you became anime radicalized.
Yeah, man. And I've been the same ever since, quite literally.
It's so funny that, like, those moments were, like, I imagine that it was similar when you first heard Jocko, where you're just sort of like, what?
Yeah. It was like it put me on my ass, you know. It was kind of like, whoa, you know, and
yeah,
again, as an illustrator or, you know, something I do wish I went to school for illustration, because it's like, that's the, I've been drawing just as long as I've played bass, but I just don't have as much discipline in it. It's one of those things where it's like, the illustrator in me and like that part of it would be like, oh my gosh, like, whoa, you know, like, man, like, it was just the color. Yeah. It was intense, you know?
Yeah, I get it. It's all loaded up. There's a whole, like, the style of anime, even though it's not my thing or I don't know enough about it, it definitely has, it seems a bit more sort of sexual than just regular Marvel stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, I feel like in anime, a lot of the times they don't limit it to, you know, this whole idea that it's a child's thing. It's kind of a thing, yeah, where it's like, nah, this is an adult and child world, and it's like, just like in reality, like this is also reality, you know?
And did you get sucked into the Reddits and stuff, into the communities around anime? Because that seems to have gone kind of bad.
Yeah, no, I would just watch cartoons. That's literally, okay, like, I would just be watching cartoons. Not like, I'm not one of those guys that likes to discuss it, unless it's with another anime nerd, you know, where it's like, you
right,
know.
Right. Like, so this Grammy nomination is, are you excited? You must be excited.
It's pretty trippy, man. Like, I you know, I'm excited. I'm definitely like tripped out. I'm kind of like, whoa, you know, like, cool.
What is the category?
Progressive R&B, I think.
What now, who else is in that category?
Janae Aiko, Chloe and Halle. Janae Aiko, Chloe, Halle, the Free Nationals.
Isn't that wild, though? Like, you know, you can't, like, there's a whole group of you in your own different ways that have sort of entered this uncharted territory of music where they, you know, like, even you can't label it. You know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, and I'm really excited that, again, it's like, it's all family in there, you know, for the most part. The Free Nats, like,
yeah,
those are my bros, like, for real, for real. And so is Janae. Janae is, like, she's like family, you know?
Oh, right, sure, of course. And I guess Beyonce has been nominated in that category before.
Word, okay, there you go.
So it's a little more, so it's not like it's out of the mainstream, you know, in a sense.
Right, you know? Right, it's yeah. it still meets, you know?
Well, I wish you all the luck, man. It was great talking to you.
Damn, man, thank you for having me. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, man, it's, you know, and hopefully we'll have a better year. Sorry for your recent losses, and you know, time does make it a little easier, buddy.
Yeah.
All right, man, take care of yourself.
Thank you, man.
All right, that was Thundercat. Fucking brilliant musician. And kind of, you know, what would you call him? He's a real nerd in a good way. Beautiful nerd man. Amazing bass player. The album is called It Is What It Is. And the musicianship, the songwriting is great. Love that guy. Just remember, fascism is bad. And we're in fucking trouble. God bless America. Here's some guitar. Don't get the plague. Hammer lives. And Monkey and La Fonda and Cat Angels everywhere. And I fucked up right at the end there. I just fucked it up just right at the end there. But we're going to leave it.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.